Yeah.
Okay, hello. Welcome to Ours is the Theory. And also, just on a side note, before we crack on, have you seen the website I put together?
Oh, I've glanced at it, but I
You
haven't
glanced?
actually looked at
Oh, okay.
anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, because you've been on it, so like there's nothing there that you don't like need to know, but I'm
I
quite
think I followed the link when you initially sent it, and then I haven't had a chance to have a proper cruise.
So for anyone listening to this, and you want to, I don't know, you can now subscribe to Ours is the Theory and all that kind of stuff on a pod as a podcast for proper. So
Ooh, we're
there you go.
official.
You can go to projectchronicle.org, and I think that does everything. But if you just like search it for your podcast app, we should come up. There's no other podcast called Ours is a Theory because it's a fucking genius title, which I think that was you, Jenny, wasn't it?
It was. I think I sent you
Yeah.
like I was in a really punny mood. I don't know if I was sober, and I think I sent you like 40 different Game of Thrones pun names. Ours is the theory went out pretty. I think I just basically looked up all of the house names and was like, "Would this one work? Would this one work?" And yeah.
Yeah. Also, oh, one thing about on the YouTube side of things that I noticed, I don't know if you caught this with the last one that we did, but there's this new collab. Do you know the collaborations feature that they brought in for the YouTube videos?
Yeah.
I've glanced at it, but I haven't really worked out how it works.
Okay,
I've
cool.
seen it other I've seen people do that now.
Yeah. It's really good, actually. Once I put this up, I'll send you a link, Jenny. And what that link does, it takes you into your YouTube studio, and you can then sort of like get your name put on the video
Oh,
as
okay.
like a collaborator on that video. So
I
it,
like that makes sense.
yeah. So it hooks into like all the people that subscribe to you will you know that video will be like shown to them and all that kind of thing. So it's like for collaborations, which I thought was
Nice. Maybe I should revive my channel after 10 years.
I mean, I, for the first time in, I think it must be nearly 15 years. I think it was my 14th or 15th year YouTube anniversary this year. I forgot to post my YouTube anniversary video,
Oh.
which is usually the one a year that I actually do post, even
Yeah,
if I
yeah,
only
yeah.
post one or two other videos the whole year. I've got it on my phone. I just never posted it. I'm a
Because,
bad YouTuber.
oh no, you're a Twitch streamer now, really, aren't you? Are you Twitch? I mean,
I mean, I haven't been
oh
doing
yeah.
much of that either, to be honest. I've been bad at interneting recently.
Oh, well, at least you're a podcaster now for proper.
Oh yes, I'm back in the
Yeah. So, yeah, I tell you what, though, I've been looking forward to this since it came
Yeah.
out. So I know I hope I'm really interested to hear all your notes about this, Jenny. I'm assuming you've got some sort of notes.
I mean, I'm gonna have to confess, I have only had a chance to watch this once and I didn't make notes.
Shocking,
So a lot of
shocking.
this is gonna be literal just
I
thoughts that are stored in my brain, rather than things that I cross off as we go down the list. And at the end, I'm like, oh, one more thing, I wrote down that this happened. So a lot of this is just gonna be pure memory.
No worries.
So I apologize, and also it might be better for me improvising. I don't know. I often feel like I hog the screen too much when I have
No.
notes. But yes.
I watched it twice, but I did not take notes, but I think I
Ooh.
remember it pretty well,
Yeah.
and
I
I
mean, the
have
thing is,
it up in my window.
it's half hour episodes, which, well, actually, this one is 40 minutes for some reason.
Yeah, this one's longer. It's a
But,
pilot, lack of a better term.
This one definitely feels like a pilot. Like it sets the
Yeah.
pace, but I also feel like not like it was very much a setup episode.
Yeah. I definitely felt like there was one of the things I made a mental note of, if not a physical note of, was the obviously Game of Thrones episode one, season one, the pilot for the original series had a lot of what is now considered relatively cringeworthy exposition dumps
Oh my
and
God, there
whatnot.
really were, weren't there?
They really were. While this one, I could feel every single non-exposition dump screenwriter's tool being used instead. So there was like there's the classic the two things that you can use to make a sympathetic character is the two screenwriting shorthands to quickly make a sympathetic character through their actions is the kick the dog, save the cat scenario.
What's that?
So the kick the dog is to create empathy with the lead character, and that you can also do this with villains, which is basically making your lead character suffer in such a way that you can then go, oh well, I can see where they're coming from,
Okay, yeah.
see what they're coming through. And like the fact that we had multiple flashbacks to Dunk's childhood was immediately like, ah, okay, cool. We're establishing why we're meant to feel for this character. We can understand where they're coming from. We can immediately empathize with them because they have suffered. That is the kicking the dog screenwriting
Okay,
technique.
yeah.
And then the saving the cat screenwriting technique is to have your main hero or protagonist do an action by which they are giving back to the community or saving someone, and that shows their character as virtue. And that one they haven't done as much yet, but the fact that he's nice to the camp followers and that sort of thing, he's already shown in his actions that he is good for other reasons,
Yeah.
and I could just feel that being kind of forward. And then the exposition tool of using a animal as a non-responsive monologue partner.
Oh, yeah.
It's another
The
one that I
horses are
noticed
great.
where the like having horses, or pets, or like one of the best examples I can think of, the kind of side character introduced just to give the lead character a chance to explore it, is in the adaptation of Bleak House, where they gave one of the villains a clerk, and so in order to have him basically say all the stuff that would have been his internal monologue, but to someone. So they obviously did that quite prolifically, and I noticed a lot of those tools coming in, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed because it's very effective shorthand.
It
It
is.
tells you a lot about the characters.
But also, it's like this show is obviously, it's a change of pace, it's a change of tone, and
Very, so.
it
Very,
is,
yeah, and it tells you that right away.
yeah, I mean,
A
it tells you that right
bit
away
on
with
the
the
nose, perhaps.
yeah with the projectile diarrhea in it.
Yeah.
It might have been a little bit much,
wasn't
you know.
there?
I get what it was going for, but it was a little much.
It wasn't nodding at the fourth wall. It was slapping the fourth wall in the face.
It was shitting in the direction of the fourth wall.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it was a bit like, oh, okay, you've kind of just like right in the first, what was it, 30 seconds or something. No,
I'd say
it's 3
about four
minutes,
minutes.
4 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's but also like the whole beats of it are something like, I don't know, I want to say like almost, and I'm saying this now because me and Rosie are about to start watching this, is Merlin, or
Okay,
something like lighter, A Knight's Tale, or
it feels very Knight's Tale. It does feel very
yeah.
Knight's Tale. It's got that vibe. And I did notice from just a content for like a general appeal, the fact that the opening like warning at the beginning of the thing said this program might con does contain strong language or something, language that people might find offensive. And I was like, what's that? No sexual content, no like violence. Like obviously that might happen in later episodes,
There
but
was some violence here, wasn't there? Was there? There
well,
was,
there wasn't
right?
like bloody, like it wasn't Game of Thrones violence.
It
It wasn't
wasn't Ramsay Bolton
dragon
violence.
violence. It was just, you know, fighting. I'd say this, at least episode one, is pretty PG-13.
Oh, actually, okay, I'll tell you what, I've got it on IMDb here. What is the actual rating of it? It is, what does it say? What does it say? TVMA, which I think means mature, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I can see it definitely progressing as the episodes progress. But there was no tits. There was no like in, if you comparison it, compare it to episode one of Game of Thrones or episode one of House of the Dragon. Episode one of Game of Thrones had, you know, exposition and siblings, and episode one of House of the Dragon had castration.
Which one was the castration? Was that when Damon?
Daemon was punishing people in something.
Yeah, that's it.
That's right.
And that was from my, I haven't rewatched that recently, but from my memory, it was relatively explicit. This
We
has nothing akin to that.
No, not at all. We watched House of the Dragon in the run up to this, It holds up really well, actually. Really, really well.
Hey.
And do you know what? I'm going to say something wholly unpopular. I don't even think that Game of Thrones ended too badly. There are a lot of things I'd have done differently, but I don't... I think after, now that the dust has settled, I don't think it has... I still enjoyed it right up to the end for the most part, despite all its flaws.
I think I need to rewatch it.
It's just like the popular thing now just to shit on it and say it was the worst thing ever. But it really... It was just rushed, is what I'll say.
If you were justifiably able to enjoy seasons like 5, 6, 7, then you should have been able to forgive season 8.
It would have infinitely been better if they had two full seasons, one Battle of the Long Night and then King's Landing. With the King's Landing, you know, was it the Bells episode being relatively early on and then the majority of that season being like the rebuilding. I think that's one of the bits that I think was definitely rushed was, you know, all these new people are in these positions of power. How does the world look? What's the aftermath, right? Like Game of Thrones, one of the things I always felt it did really well was the aftermath of things like battles and stuff like that. And they obviously didn't really get a chance to do much of that in the final series. They did a little bit with the Long Night battle. And also, I do kind of feel like, and this is more aesthetic than anything else, I would like to have seen more of the Night King and a bit more of the,
For a show so dedicated to character work in general, the fact that the Night King is still a blank slate of villainy, and they didn't really commit to him being just a force of pure nature that couldn't be resolved, and they didn't really commit to him being any sort of character, so I think being disappointed in the end of Game of Thrones is still perfectly valid. I think the writing was on the wall early enough that I'm not mad anymore. I think if I were to rewatch it, I don't think I'd be angry. I think I'd still feel a bit...
There's so much they could have done better if they'd had more time, sure. But it's still good up to the end. I think with the Night King, the way that I read it, was the Night King and the White Walkers and everything. They were supposed to be the orcs from Lord of the Rings. Like they were supposed to be not generic bad guy, but like it's not important why they're bad. Yeah. Like a force of nature, it doesn't really matter why they're bad. It just matters that they're an overwhelming force. And I think that's lifted very much from Tolkien, I think. Lifted or, you know, homage to or whatever word you want to use, but like I think that's one of the things that comes direct from Lord of the Rings, which I finally got around to watching and I really did enjoy.
I've forgotten that we had this conversation that you hadn't watched Lord of the Rings. Oh my god.
And
now understand like my personality like 50% more having seen Lord of the Rings?
But also I watched me and Rosie watched Rings of Power. And I really liked that too.
I will say, Rings of Power is perfectly acceptable, pretty dumb fun. I find it visually nice enough to look at, and I find it dumb fun. I find some of the plot logic and the script writing a little bit tricky to get behind because it's just it's a very hard thing to sell, Rings of Power, because Lord of the Rings is a classic like hero's journey story, and the adaptation at least grounded it in somewhat of a reality, and so it's got kind of the baseline's quite set, and obviously House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, and now A Knight of the Seven Kingdom is very grounded and very much in a very foundational kind of earthly reality.
Mm-hmm.
Rings of Power I struggle with because I think the writers struggled with the dichotomy that the way that the Silmarillion and that era of Tolkien is written, it's very mythic and poetical and lyrical.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to have a very somewhat kind of earthy character-based thing,
but
also deal with the epic mythology kind of story. And for me, it feels just a little bit disconnected as an experience. It's pretty enough, and I enjoyed it enough. I love it. Nope.
I did like it. Like I'm not as deep into the world of Lord of the Rings, the lore and all that kind of stuff. So I can only look at it from the surface, but yeah, like peering into the world. I know that they made some substantial changes to how the rings are done, made, brought into the world. Am I right? Like, is there some substantial
I mean, like I said, the way that the Silmarillion, again, I've only read some segments from Silmarillion. My sister read the Silmarillion like 13 or 14. She's the kind of the Tolkien scholar of the family. Me, Lord of the Rings. I've read Lord of the Rings in full, I think, 3 times. And I've watched the film literally more than times than I could count. Literally. So I think my issue isn't necessarily with the mythology and with how the story is presented. I think from what I can tell of, as I said, how the Silmarillion tells the story of the forging of the rings, it's kind of, it's mythic. It's like, it's not a specific like process. It's not a like if you add, you know, this ingredient, like it's much more lyrical. So a bit more, if you think like Greek mythology type sort of storytelling. So it doesn't really matter the specifics as much as the overall feeling and the intention. And I just feel like when you zoom in very close on the characters and go, what would motivate them to do this? It takes away from the mythology and the lyrical nature of it. And then it obviously, if you're taking away from that, and then you don't necessarily give characters really, like, it's a soft, hard magic system. I think that's the issue, is Tolkien famously has one of the softest magic systems you can possibly have. Like his magic system is, there's magic in the world, and some people have it, some people don't, and it can do stuff. While when you're presenting it as a TV show, particularly post Game of Thrones, I think logically you want more of the, okay, it was a combination of this metal with this metal, and this person did this. And so for, again, I don't know how much of this is a general experience, and we're meant to be talking about Game of Thrones, and we've gotten into Rings of Power. But for me personally, I found that it was fine enough, but neither made enough logical sense, nor did it make enough like poetic, lyrical, like metaphorical sense. Like I couldn't enjoy it as this abstract feat of beauty and poetry, and I also couldn't enjoy it as a, 1 sec, if this character is doing this, how long did it take to get them from here to here? And that's why I don't love it. I enjoy it. It was fine. It was an entertaining enough watch.
Okay, put it this way. Have you seen Wheel of Time?
I have.
How does it stack up against Wheel of Time in your opinion? Just as a show now.
On the show side of things, so I have actually read some Wheel of Time now. I will say it's a similar issue between Rings of Power, Witcher and Wheel of Time, that the modern adaptations often seemingly miss the point. And I can see exactly where the writers are coming from, but I feel like there's some level of disconnect between what the author's intention is, the stories, and how it's adapted. And because of that, it just feels off, and it's very hard for me to describe it in a way that's logical, because I think just because I've over my many many years of watching audio commentaries and behind the scenes and all of this stuff, which for me is a foundational part of how I enjoy visual media, I can feel when there's like a writing disconnect between the source material and the adaptation, and sometimes I can feel it with the knowledge. So with, I'd say with Rings of Power, I had the knowledge to understand why I was feeling that. When I watched The Witcher, I could feel it without realizing what it was, but I had a slightly better idea of what it was because I played the games, but I could feel there was something not quite right. And
You know
then
what
it was,
show gets that really right? Have you seen Fallout?
Oh yeah.
I've heard nothing but great things about Fallout because they get the tone,
Well,
yeah, they do.
it's written by the same people, isn't it? It's all
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And no, look, I'll be entirely honest, having not read A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms,
mm-hmm.
Or the Duncan Egg series,
mm-hmm.
I think tonally this show makes sense.
Yeah.
This feels like...
And George R. Martin seems to agree. Did you see the interview that he did recently? There's stuff that's coming out about it.
I might have to look it up.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel tonally disconnected. Same way that those other three modern big fantasy shows did.
So what's the gist of the interview?
Just I only saw bits and pieces, but George R. R. Martin says this is you know he thinks that the Hedge Knight is like the best story he's ever written, might be one of his personal favorites, and he says he has a good relationship with the showrunner of this show and mm-hmm. thinks he totally gets it. And then he shit on Ryan Condal a little bit and House of the Dragon. So I think he seems to be happy with this.
Is Ryan Condal doing?
Showrunner of House of the Dragon.
That's it. I see. The thing is, okay. So I followed the beef between Ryan Condal and George Martin, and it's like I think Condal makes some substantially difficult but necessary decisions.
I think that he made some decisions that. I disagree with, and I think George R. R. Martin probably disagrees with them on a very deep personal level. And then I think it's just, I don't know. We can talk about House of the Dragon when we get this.
Is that coming this year? I think is it.
I think it's probably coming next year at this point. Oh. I don't know.
I think House of the Dragon, in the same way that the Silmarillion versus Ring of the Power, is potentially the hardest to adapt to screen.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel like in terms of actual just pure adaptability, can you imagine if they started, instead of doing Game of Thrones, started with The Knight of the Seven Kingdoms?
Which one did you say was the most difficult to adapt?
House of the Dragon.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It's based on a history book.
Yeah.
It's based on a history book, which is deliberately obscured by unreliable narrators. In terms of actual straight adaptation, Knight of the Seven Kingdoms seems genuinely the easiest.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It's a more
one story, like one point
so
of view.
Contained.
It is,
so,
and also
like single protagonist, like dual protagonist.
There's a few things that they put in for the sake of making it more TV friendly, but they weren't stuff. It wasn't things that were out of place. I can't remember off the top of my head what I'm. Oh, things like so they made things like Plumber more funny. They gave him more of a pleasant, like a more entertaining screen presence and stuff like that. He's the clerk guy, by the way. That all kind of works. All right, listen, I'll tell you what. What did you make of is it Lionel Baratheon?
Yeah,
Laughingstone.
Oh, character.
He's really cool. Like, I didn't know what to make of him at first, but just like, I don't know, just he's got good energy.
Yeah. Well, how much do you two know about the story, where this is going?
I've been spoiled for the main plot points, but I haven't physically read the book.
Yeah, I pretty much know everything that's going to happen, but not in detail.
Okay, so you don't mind if I talk about what this is all leading up to?
Well, spoiler alert for anyone who's listening to the podcast, and then continue.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
although to be fair, it is dropped in the trailer. Like I don't.
Yeah.
So okay, I'm just like and I'm not going to give explicits. Well, you know, things that I think would ruin it. But what this is gearing up towards is what's called a trial by seven. So it's going to be seven knights versus seven knights in a trial, and I'm pretty sure Lionel Baratheon is on the side of Dunk. We're going to be doing basically is meeting all of these characters and building up to that big moment at the end. So it's not like a twisty-turny plot type of thing. It's almost like it's you've literally got a good side and a bad side, and you're learning about the characters that make up the good side and the characters that make up the bad side, and it's like character pieces, which was, I think, what they were trying to do with Game of Thrones badly, where they were getting characters, but like, whereas in Game of Thrones, particularly at the beginning, characters were defined by like the big actions that they took, the impact they had in the world. The characters in Seven Kingdoms they're just like personalities. And, you know, like Laughing Storm, Lionel Baratheon, it's like, what do we know about him? Not really that much. He's good at fighting and he's a bit of a party animal.
He's got a surplus of personality.
Yeah, yeah.
One could say he might be overflowing with it.
But that's like, and that's all you need. Like, he's a, you know, he's a bit of a flirt, really, isn't he? Like, he's got a bit, do you know there's a bit of gay energy there? In, you know, like,
yeah, definitely, sort of like, definitely. 100%.
Yeah.
Well, I think he was flirting.
I was going to say it. If you didn't say it, I was going to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Dunk just, you know, went over his head. He oblivious to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A naive little tall boy.
But it's, yeah, so it's, and yeah, so we're, I like how this is opening up, but I feel like, yeah, we've just, it's just an introduction at this point. We haven't even met the Targaryen guy, the bad guy in the piece at the moment. Sorry, was that a spoiler?
Well, I'm sure that there's going to be Targaryen at the very least.
I can't remember his name.
I think it's pretty much not a spoiler to say that the guy in the Lord that Dunk sees in the tavern is a Targaryen.
I thought it would be.
We already have potentially, again, no spoilers specifically, but we have one primary Targaryen character already, well established.
Oh, Egg.
If not named.
I was
skirting around the edge of it, but you know, just dive into that.
Are we supposed to know he's Targaryen? It's like, if you don't know Game of Thrones, are you going to be surprised that, like, I don't know, I think
the reveal is going to come pretty soon in the next few episodes, isn't it? I mean,
only watch Game of Thrones, and there's less of, if you've read the books, there's a lot more like Targaryens dyeing their hair, Targaryens shaving their head, kind of established. I think people who are just watching the series who have not been spoiled, I think you could potentially not quite connect the dots, because again, it's a unaccompanied child. The only times we've ever seen Targaryen royal children, they've had guards, they've had people looking after them, all this other stuff, and instead the kid is just wandering around, like, you know, asking to become a squire.
Mm.
Like, from a, you know, political standpoint, you are completely unspoiled for this twist. It is, I think if I didn't know it, I would have been surprised by it. Now, I will say the kid actor is a sweet little bean, and I appreciate that they have not made him, like, fake a, like, I don't know, the equivalent of a King's Landing, like, commoner's accent or something. They really, like, you know, he speaks like a little lord.
Yeah, is he? Did they really shave his? Did they shave his head, or is that just like a skull cap?
No, they shaved his head.
They would have shaved his head.
That's one thing that George R. R. Martin insisted, is that no bald cap.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because I don't want to comment too much on this, but like, there's a lot of head there, isn't there?
He has got a very bulbous little head, hasn't he?
I mean, in an adorable way, like,
he's very,
you know,
cute.
Yeah, yeah. I think you know, I think that's a solid casting choice. Like,
he's a solid.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's no, like, this is pod racing. Sorry, that when I think of bad child actors,
Jake Lloyd's like, been through enough.
I know. I'm sorry. Although, yeah, yeah. I know that there's plenty of time for this to turn around, but I actually kind of, in some ways, would have liked to have seen a bit more of Egg in the first, like, I'm keen to see more of him, shall we say, because he had an interesting,
you know, when
likeable.
You get actors, you can sometimes just find them really grating and annoying.
Yeah.
I don't get that at all from
Egg. Yeah, he's interesting because he's a little bit of, like, I don't know, like, knowing that he is a Targaryen, you can pick out, like, the the sort of the personality bit. Like, for example, the fact that you just like as a go on the horse, Chestnut or something, I think it is. And it's like, yeah, if you were a little pauper common boy, you would not touch another man's horse like that. So, and that he's got
there's a level of entitlement and a level of
abandon.
Not quite fearlessness, but like self-assuredness that comes from clearly being.
Yeah. Well, clearly.
In a position of power.
Yeah, or like clearly position, just living a life where people give you the benefit of the doubt. Like, yeah. even if he's not allowed to do it, he knows that he'll just be like told, you know, just told to be on his way or something, you know.
Yeah.
Not like Dunk, where he gets a slap around the head or something.
Yeah.
What in the ear?
I'd be interested to see when we get Egg interacting with other people, because we've only had Egg interact with Doug.
So,
see how Egg, provided he hasn't revealed his identity, is treated by the other characters we've met so far.
Yeah. Oh, also, the Targaryen guy in the bar, in the tavern. I know I'm supposed to know who he is, but I...
He's Darren.
That's it, yeah.
I don't know if he's the oldest or the second oldest of Maker, who is actually the fourth son. So Egg and his brothers are currently not in line for the throne because their father has an older brother who we're going to see in the show.
Ah, good.
As well. And he also has a son. So right now, Egg is like nowhere near to inheriting the throne. He's like Prince Harry's kids or something.
Yeah.
I could go on
about it for a little while later on, but I did find it really interesting that obviously world building in Game of Thrones is all over the place. It's the north, mm-hmm. it's the south, it's the over in the east. It's jumping around all over the place, and they really have to establish different cultures and different characters all at the same time. So it's been all over the place. And then in House of the Dragon, it was not so much establishing different places or different cultures, but really establishing how the heck the family works and all of the different like characters and how they relate to each other, particularly given all of the similar names and similar hair. This one is all in one place, establishing characters who are basically all from the same area.
All from
Westeros proper, not from east or etc. And so it feels like a lot smaller, but also you can get into the more eccentric characters and more weird characters and stuff like that. So I'll be interested to see when they introduced, like, they don't need to spend at least so far establishing whose cousin is, whose brother is, who's in the line of the throne, because that's not what's interesting to Dunk at this point. But when they do introduce the Targaryen families and put a bit more detail into the current political infrastructure of the Targaryen, I wonder how they're going to introduce that in a way, because I'll be interested to know what lessons they've learned.
I will say touching on what you said about Dunk having, you know, a different perspective on things, and I really like how we're going to get like an actual story about like one of the small folk, kind of, you know. We didn't really get that in Game of Thrones. We're sort of started getting it in House of the Dragon a little bit. But this is...
Yeah, I mean...
It was just a different side.
Yeah, the thing that is like the big glaring sort of thing about it is that it's like... So it seems to me that it's been fundamentally established that Dunk is not a real knight. Like, he wasn't knighted...
I think they're keeping it vague enough, but yeah, it's pretty, they paint it in such a way that he's probably might be lying about.
I did enjoy that as a yet another tonal step away from Game of Thrones. I mean, obviously they literally shit on the Game of Thrones theme song. but like one of like the core like direction/writing rules for the Game of Thrones series is no flashbacks, no dreams. Yeah. And they had one flashback in the whole of Game of Thrones, which was Cersei's flashback. And that still feels kind of weird and jarring, particularly that one, of all of the flashbacks to have.
Yeah.
And they had one dream sequence, but it was more of a vision quest with Bran. But even those ones were kind of...
They had consequences.
They had consequences, and they were really like... at the point where they were presenting it to screen, it was shown as the fundamental truth of the world. While they're in the Game of Thrones book, there's so many dreams that are metaphoric and amorphous and hard to pin down and could be truth, could be, you know, anything. Well, the way that Game of Thrones presented anything like that, it had to be a presentation of the reality of the series. Like, there wasn't any dream sequences that were muddled in lies or, you know, metaphor or...
Except for one. There was one. There was. I think it was... I want to say it's when Carth, House of the Undying, and...
Well, that was more a vision quest than a dream. But yeah, okay, but again, the main one with that was no flashbacks. And then even House of the Dragon did a bit more like hallucinations with Daemon. But that's the closest you get.
Yeah.
And then in this one, they are fully establishing that flashbacks are just a part of the like written infrastructure of this series.
It's kind of like a Family Guy cutaway.
Yes, I was just thinking that. It was...
And it's mostly for gags.
Yeah.
Not entirely for gags so far.
And when they do it, you notice they do something with the picture, like they make the edges of the screen fuzzy, like it's like a memory of Dunk's, like, you know.
They do like cool,
noticed.
What's it called? Like a close focus.
Yeah. Like a filtery type of thing. I'm just trying to find it now. And it's obvious, and it's for tone rather than to reveal something to the audience. Because the one thing that I've always... Game of Thrones didn't really do this very much. There might be one or two occasions with it. But one of the things I really don't like that TV shows do is they deliberately obfuscate something from the audience in order to artificially muster up mystery. So it's like the characters know something, but you don't. And the only reason you don't is because they're trying to build some sort of tension or something. And it's like, it's not used as to reveal information or to give the audience information that they wouldn't otherwise know, or to catch the audience up to speed with things. It's more like, it's more tonal, more for gags, more for just like,
it's the equivalent of it's the equivalent of, here's a point, here's an example, which means that it's not trying to double back on itself. It's just trying to reestablish the truth of the matter and make it, like, it's a really good example of how to use a visual media well, where it's saying, a character's saying something, and then we're visibly shown truth of it.
Yeah.
And again, because one of the established lore generally of the whole of the Game of Thrones franchise so far has been, if they're showing it at all, it is objective truth. So all the flashbacks we've had so far have been this happened, an example of this. And so it visually shows you, so you can connect with the characters, particularly if this is going to be a very grounded, like close quarters, less characters, less establishing, you know, international politics and international like culture. It's going to be all predominantly in one place with characters coming in. You can spend more time going, this character and this is their experience.
Yeah.
Which I'm enjoying. It did feel a bit, I think I got the feeling that this, because it's so contained in comparison to what we're used to, it does feel somewhat, it feels more small folk. It feels physically smaller. It feels like there's a smaller cast. It feels like there's this going on. And it feels like...
Lower stakes.
Lower stakes to a certain extent. It feels very different just in terms of tone. It's so, like, refreshing.
Yeah, but also one of the gags that I noticed, which was very Game of Thrones, was the dressing up the sex worker to be dead.
That one was like, I was interested to see whose kink that was.
Yeah.
At some point, are we going to have a payoff for whose kink that is?
Is the redhead? I think it was implied it was the redhead guy that,
Well, I enjoyed the implication he wanted all of his followers to have red hair. I think all of the camp followers that worked under him had to dye their hair red. At least that's what it seems. So, there was a throwaway line about now we're all red.
So it's established that Dondarrion is a bit of a knobhead, really, isn't it? He might be on the back.
Yeah.
So, which is like disappointing because Beric Dondarrion, I really enjoyed him as a character in Game of Thrones. Would have, you know, like obviously he's a substantial.
You
descendant.
Can't help who your ancestors are.
You can't. No, you can't. It's like, do you know how nice your great 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 grandson is? One of the things I am kind of interested in is, so this is about, what is this, like 80 years after Dance of the Dragons?
Yeah, it's like about halfway between Dragons in Game of Thrones.
Is there going to be anyone here that will remember dragons? No.
I don't think any When did the dragons die again? Because the current king is Aegg's grandfather, Daeron, but he's not going to be much longer for this world, I think.
You have to check the law.
Yeah, but the thing is, they would have to be like, I mean, how old was Aemon Targaryen when he died? 101 or something like that?
Mr. Aemon.
And that was an exceptionally old man. Like, also, Jenny, you might know this. I wouldn't expect you to get it, Max, because it's old British comedy stuff. Do you know Porridge with Ronnie Barker?
Cultural osmosis, not actively watched, but I may have caught it on TV when things came along.
Okay, so in that...
It's a specific quote, probably not.
A TV show called Porridge?
A TV show called Porridge. It's on BBC iPlayer. It's good. Like, it's one of those ones where... It was made in the 70s, and I think it's aged relatively well. Some of the jokes have shown their age, but like for the most part, it's still up on BBC iPlayer, and it's good. I really enjoy it. But the crime lord that runs the prison, it's a prison comedy. And the guy, the criminal top dog in the prison, is played by the same guy that plays Aemon Targaryen. But you would never recognize them. Yeah, because he's kind of old. He's about 50 something in Porridge. Like, he looks about 50 something in Porridge. But anyway, yeah, I don't know if anyone, like, think, you know.
Again, I think your cultural childhood osmosis, not actively watching it, but enough that I know that I knew what it was.
Sorry, Jenny, I think you're blipping out there a bit.
Oh, sorry.
No worries. To be honest, if you're looking for a vintage comedy, then I do recommend it. But one thing as well, actually, going back to the Lionel Baratheon bit, that actually takes a substantial part of the episode. I'm just scanning through it now. It's basically
one of the things I noticed from the feeling that this feels like a much smaller character based thing is there's a lot more long establishing shots where they're setting the scene, and like the whole dance sequence.
Yeah.
It's a long dance sequence just taking the time to breathe is great.
Yeah. The whole like Lionel Baratheon bit, that's a 10-minute scene on a 40-minute pilot. So that's quite But then again, he is an important character and
one of the things I loved, and this is just a me thing, I would have made a note of it if I had a pen and paper, is that I think I commented in, I think it was House of the Dragon, I don't remember which character it was. Yeah, it was House of the Dragon when one of the twins went off and time with the pirate lady. And there was a dance sequence involving a like...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think I commented when we did that podcast that I really enjoyed the fact that they didn't take one cultural dance vocabulary. They created their own dance vocabulary for that one sequence.
Yeah.
And it was similar for the dance sequence during the Baratheon one, where the dance moves that were used have some similarity to like English folk dancing or Cayley folk dancing or... I don't know, Dartmoor step, but none of it's quite syncing up. There was a particular move they had with like his arms, like being like raised at the cross guard, which is kind of like Russian country dancing, but none of it was quite a dance form that I recognized. And I really enjoy that because, just from a cultural standpoint, make it not of this sort of our world is great.
It was shot very well. And I like the tent, all the set looked really good with all the antlers and everything.
Yeah.
Very unique.
Now, I
enjoyed the fact that they've got a tent, but they put up chandeliers inside a tent.
Yeah.
Like, if ever there was a show.
An antler chandelier like that, you're going to want to show it off.
Yeah, but inside a tent. Like, just the sheer amount of, like, so they would have, like, it's not against the lore and the foundation of the medieval period. It just is a show of wealth and power from the Baratheons.
Yeah, that's what happens.
And I enjoy it.
I
really enjoy it.
That's what you can do when you have, like, personal assistant staff. Like, you can just... That's the world. That's how the other half live. It's like, yeah, I've got servants. You know what? Bring me my chandelier.
Yeah. I mean, again, it helps establish the difference between Dunk and everyone else. And I think I commented when we watched the trailers that I like the fact that I think later on in a sequence there's sunflowers out.
Oh, yeah.
And this doesn't seem like it's set in the summer.
I mean,
so whoever sourced the sunflowers must have had wealth and influence. Decorate their pavilion with fresh sunflowers.
It looks springy, yeah.
Or if you guys can hear Mimi in the background, she's doing a bit of a trolling scream right now.
Oh, Mimi.
So I did do a little bit of scanning for heraldry. Oh my God, I'm forgetting. See, I should have wrote the notes down. The sun and the chevron. That's the people that are hosting it. What are they called? I've fucked that up. So it's all in the Reach. They're like a lesser house of the Reach. We do see Tyrell Rose. We do see, obviously, we see the Baratheons, Dondarrions.
Fossaways.
I saw a little Beesbury.
I didn't see a Beesbury. Where was the Beesbury?
The Beesbury. I'll try and find the Beesbury for you. Hang on a minute. There it is. It's 15 minutes, 35 seconds. There's Baratheons on the right and Beesbury on the left. Beesbury.
Also, just look at the shot of the outside of the Baratheon tent is nuts. The sheer number of antlers is nuts.
Yeah, I mean, in the grand scale of things, like, out of all of the families, the Baratheons are up, you know, they're one of the top ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, going back far enough, they're a bastard branch of the Targaryens, actually.
Yeah, that's cool.
So there were some Lannisters. Hang on a minute. Jason Lannister and what was the other one? The two twins from House of the Dragon. Tycho? No.
I can't remember, but I know who you're talking about, the twins.
Thailand,
yeah, that's it, yeah. I wanted to say Tywin, it's not Tywin, obviously. Thailand.
That would be crazy for them to have the same
two
name.
Two people in the family with their same
Yeah. There's the lady that Dunk has a crush on. She makes it in. We do see a recurring story, the knight with the mirror shield, that Shireen Baratheon tells us back in Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm. Also, that dragon puppet was cool.
That was, yeah,
that
yeah.
was awesome.
Yeah, that was one for the TV show. In the books, I believe it's a smaller puppet show. But you know, this is a show about. I don't want to say like it's a show on a more superficial level than what we might be used to, but it is. There is a bit of like fanfare and showmanship and razzle dazzle that sort of. Goes into it. And I did find it quite amusing. It's like, so why are you here? I go, dinner?
Supper.
I like the fact they made him...
That makes sense.
...likeably naive and honest. Mm. Like, those things that could be very Latin America boring character traits, when you put someone who is honest and well-meaning in a world full of all of this complicated stuff, it makes and instantly likable, because you're not thinking, oh, maybe they've got another agenda. You're thinking, mm-hmm. well, he's a nice enough lad trying his best.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Mr. Baratheon is like, hey, dude, yeah, sure. Like, that's nice.
Yep. Also, side note, the only nudity we really see is actually Dunk himself.
I did actually find there was some tits in there. The prostitute who's pretending to be dead.
Oh, all right, yeah, tits watch. Let's get on it.
There is also a tit in the tree at the beginning of the thing, but it might be a tit. It might be Ren.
I thought it was a robin.
Oh, it might be Robin, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Honestly, the thing is, like, this is rated, was it 8.5 on IMDb, I think? 8.2, which is a very, like, considering the reputation and the, you know, nature of people, that's pretty good going, really, isn't it? For a pilot episode.
Yeah.
To be honest, I've yet to feel like my teeth can sink into it, but that's just the nature of, like, setting us up, because the whole series takes place at this tournament. So I'm kind of surprised that we've actually seen as much as we have, because it feels like... But then again...
How many episodes is it? Six or eight?
Six of about half an hour each.
Okay.
So
they're going to... The pace, I think, seems like it should go pretty good.
Yeah.
Considering they only have half hour... So it's another like 2.5 hours.
Yeah, this is a long film. I mean, I like it. I like that they've kept it brisk. They couldn't have made it. I don't imagine that they'd have been able to make it much longer than this without padding it out.
Yeah.
And it's not like there's a wealth of stuff already in it. Like, it is fundamentally a what you call it, like a bedtime story kind of thing.
Yeah.
But George R. R. Martin reckons he's got 10 of these mini stories in him. And it almost seems possible that he might even write those out and, like, never quite finishing Song of Spring and what's the other one?
Winds of Winter.
Winds of Winter, that's it. Yeah. Do you know what? George R. R. Martin should just hire some people to finish the books at this stage.
Yeah, he should just get some ghostwriters in.
Lay down the core beats.
That's another thing he talks about in the interview, is that because someone at like a Comic-Con or something, a clip went viral of them saying, why don't you just give Song of Ice and Fire to Brandon Sanderson to finish or something like that.
Oh, God, that's such a cliche at this point.
He talked about in the interview that he was offended by that, but he also feels bad that he hasn't finished, you know, same old thing he's been saying for the last
ages.
5+ years.
Like, don't get me wrong, he'll have I'm sure he's probably got the crux of the story.
Well, he says he has over 1,100 pages, I think, in Winds of Winter done, but he just goes back and rewrites things.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Has he said anything about is he on a Dream of Spring?
I think he hasn't even finished Winds of Winter yet, so I don't know if maybe he's just like holding everything back and then he's just gonna drop them like both one right after the other, like just be like, I'm done.
I think the other thing is the way that Game of Thrones is written as POV chapters.
Mm-hmm.
He might have written POV for one character from, you know, two books down the line.
Yeah.
Have that done and finished and he's content with it. But then the other characters he's still got to backfill.
Yeah.
And then obviously you've got to have the chronology of that plotted out and written out. Be happy with how the beginning, middle and end flows of one singular novel with that structure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he probably has, you know, maybe a third of the next book and a third of the next book written and 5/8 of the current book written, and you know, he could slot some chapters here or there, but he's not happy with the structure. I don't know.
The trouble is, I kind of feel for him because he seems like he's like, I don't know how much he's going to differ from the series. I'd be quite interested to see how that pans out. Because when I was doing the rewatch, like, there is a degree of logic to how it panned out, but it got there way too fast for it to really make, not make sense, but to feel right. Like, yeah, like, I will always, always, always reserve that Theon should have been the one to kill the Night King. That I will go with. He is the Prince of Winterfell, as is determined by the title of the episode. As in, do you remember the episode when he took over Winterfell? I think he was the Prince of Winterfell. Prince that was promised. There you go, killed the Night King.
It's been a while since I've rewatched Game of Thrones.
Well, when he hanged or burned those poor little farm kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Theon's a good guy.
I agree with you that Theon should have killed the Night King, but I still think that Arya killing the Night King makes no sense.
I think the Arya killing the Night King is one of those things that could be made to make sense if they had more time. I'm not saying that it didn't make sense, but also one of the things I am now of the belief that the Waif is the person that we see to be Arya Stark. So here's the way that I got to it, right? So when the faceless men take the face of someone, they also take their memories and their personalities, right? So mm-hmm. it's not just aesthetic. It's like they sort of merge with the person, not in a dissimilar way to how the Three-Eyed Raven works. There's probably some like overlapping magic there. So the Waif takes Arya Stark. It doesn't even have to, like, takes Arya Stark's face, wears it, and then carries on Arya Stark's journey. That's what it feels like to me.
It's a good conspiracy, but it doesn't make any sense for her to kill the Night King either. So,
as with any Game of Thrones theory, like, if it's in your head canon and it brings you joy, go for it.
Oh, come on! That's so condescending. Like, come on.
I didn't mean it's condescending. I meant it like, you know, find the joy. Like the classic the prince who was promised could be anyone type thing.
Yeah.
Someone has in their brain space that it's Arya or Jon or Daenerys or whatever. Like that is okay. Like that's how the story is written.
It's okay to be that stupid, Chris. Yes. Special boy. So here's the thing, right? So the faceless men, you know, they're pretty on it. They have the wisdom of many different faiths in the story. They understand there is some, you know, they understand the laws and legends around the winds coming in from the north, all that kind of stuff, right? And they basically want to send an assassin to kill the Night King. So they do it using Arya Stark's face, and then they do it, and then the faceless men killed the Night King. Della, the end. So that
okay, I'm with you, but why do the faceless men care about Westeros or killing the Night King?
Because if the Night King if the Night King comes all the way, well, first of all, the faceless men do operate in Westeros. We see Jack and Hagar in Westeros,
right? So but they seem to be based out of Essos. The Jackin's the only one you see in. I guess you were there.
And Syrio Forel, he is obviously a faceless man, in my opinion. So that's
he's from Braavos?
Yeah, well, he's from Braavos. And I'm not saying all Braavosi are, you know, faceless men. That would be racist. But I do kind of feel like, oh, right, okay, so if a First Sword of Braavos, which, as I understand it, you don't technically retire from being the First Sword of Braavos. It's a little bit like the Kingsguard in that regard. Like you don't go into teaching once you've become the First Sword of Braavos, right? That is a career path that doesn't generally happen. You generally die in the role, but like, okay, so the First Sword of Braavos dies in the role, faceless men get his face, and then they go and start training Arya to kill the Night King. It starts from right at the beginning, and they train Arya with Syrio Forel. Then once all the shit happens, then Jack and Hagar comes in as her as the faceless man guiding Arya, which is why they use Jack and Hagar's face again at the House of Black and White. And then they bring Arya in. They sort of bring Arya into the fold to become a faceless man. Whether or not that's the way for using her face, or whether or not that's, you know, Arya but a faceless man. I think it's one of those things where it's like, well, it doesn't even matter. The same result happens. And then...
You're selling me.
And then they, in order to protect generally the world, because like the Night King going to stop at Westeros or whatever like that. Like, you know, the faceless men do have some sense of, I don't know if it's justice or some sense of like, you know, not letting the world fall apart, you know, some sense of something. They maneuver Arya to kill the Night King. Because she is the one that says to the God of Death, not today.
So. How did they find out about the Night King? Did someone tell them Aegon's dream too? Or
well, the myth does exist. Like, people do know about the White Walkers. We know that the Faceless Men know about the Northern lore because there's a Weirwood face in the House of Black and White. There are, like, idols and references to all of the known religions in Westeros and Essos in the House of Black and White. Arya even references them sometimes, or once. So there's a chance they'll know. I mean, there's not even a chance they'll know. There's almost an expectation that they'll know. So I don't know. I reckon that's at least at a legitimate interpretation. That's what I reckon. It's less Arya, more the Faceless Man. The only thing I think challenges that theory, really, is the fact that Arya then goes on to, like, you know, become an explorer, which seems a little bit out of character for the Faceless Man.
I mean, well, maybe we'll get that follow-up show one day.
I don't know if I want that follow-up show. Arya invents modern-day slavery. Reinvents slavery. They've already got slavery. I don't know. You think slavery too, even worse, the worst kind. I don't know. That's just my punt. Theon is the prince who was promised. Arya is the waif that kills the Night King. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm more with you on the second thing than the Theon thing.
I've been going back and kind of like trying to catch more details, and I've just spent like at least good like half a minute enjoying how good the knitwear is on. Mm-hmm. The Fossaway's sparring sleeves. It's some gorgeous work.
Fossaway?
Yeah.
Those are the Apple people, right?
The Apple guys who are doing their sparring. Their sleeves. Oh, the knitwear. It's gorgeous.
Whereabouts like, is all that?
Fossaway sounds like a good Apple. It sounds like a good, like, a honey.
It sounds like a good Apple. Technically, yeah. Let me see. Around 17 minutes in.
17, 18.
And he's walking past the training thing. And then there's the one who's a dick and the one who's nice.
Oh, yeah.
Their sleeves. Oh! I'm just, like, looking at all the fabric textures. I was trying to work out, so, looking at the... So there's not that many women's fashion.
No.
Obviously, there's not many female characters. Although I was interested to see in the Baratheon. And I found it interesting that most of the... Like, the dancers seem to be, like, performers there to entertain the Baratheons.
Mm-hmm.
But there was at least one lady who looked like she was just sat at the lower tables and looked like a lady. I find that interesting. I don't know whether or not she's just, like, dressing above station or whether or not she is actually a lady. But there didn't seem to be any, like, you know, it's predominantly blokes.
It is.
And given the medieval time... era as established through all of the shows so far, there wouldn't be any high-born women necessarily attending unless they're, like, you know, kept at the top table or, you know, behind awnings. But there definitely was one lady who looked like she might be a high-born in the Baratheon tent. But I was trying to work out the etymological, like, the history of the fashion of the camp followers. Because they're both wearing... very, very different fashion styles. And that's where my brain was at. But also, knitwork.
Who's the lady that you're referring to?
It's literally just one cutaway shot at the Baratheon tent. If I can find her. It's during his speech. Oh, there's a couple of them now. I'm looking back on that, but like the during his like drunken rant about things, there's a couple of ladies on the lower tables. They don't seem to be like. Then obviously all the drinking and nothing happens. So you would think highborn ladies wouldn't be allowed to participate in that.
Maybe it's not so much that they're not allowed. Maybe they just they're not interested. Like this is like blokey bloke sports, isn't it? Like, yeah, there
because
are.
Most of the highborn they interact with in the series proper are like royalty, not, you know.
Yeah, but also Baratheons are a little, they're a very, like, masculine house, right?
Yeah.
We don't actually see that many Baratheon women,
okay,
do we?
She's in blue. She's 25 minutes and 30 seconds.
I think the only Baratheon women we've seen are the daughters of. Or what's his name from House, the guy in House of the Dragon?
And there's Shireen.
Oh, Shireen.
Oh, and Shireen. Yeah.
So, I mean, it could be the case that the Baratheons just, there might be a few of the women there that just like a bit of sport, you know?
Yeah, it might not be interesting.
It might not be common, but maybe there's a few of them that enjoy a bit of hearty competition.
Maybe. It'll be interesting to see how that pans out, because there's obviously a lot of women in the background of a lot of shots, like just moving around, moving carts and whatnot. But from the actual token characters we've had, they've either been camp followers or performers. Or, you know, the tavern keeper. So it'll be interesting to see how they fill the role, or whether or not they're just filling up the crowd and making it more gender balanced.
Oh, well,
the crowd,
there'll be a lot of staff there, won't there? Like, you go to any trade show or any big event, there'll be women there that who are just there because it's their job. Men as well, of course. But also, like, I mean, just because it's your job there, you know, they can have some fun. They can dance, like, you know, you can dance if you want to.
Yeah. I just because I was mainly going just hopscotch backing for fabric details and patterns and costuming, because, you know, that's my jam. I was just interested to kind of catch more examples of the fashion of this era, because it is a new era to be presented.
This is after Dorne has joined with the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, but only just by 20 years. They've been part of the Seven Kingdoms for 20 years at this point. So I don't know. Does that's still like kind of, they're probably not. I don't know what kind of integration there was when Dorne was a separate kingdom, because it's still land, right? Like, it's still attached. There's still a bit of the, you know, it like in terms of day to day practice, does it actually make that much difference that Dorne is separate? I was wondering about this when I was rewatching Game of Thrones. Like, really, right? Like, if the biggest problem with Rob marching south was the sheer aggro it was just causing everyone. If he just fundamentally marched to the neck of the north, held up there, built a wall maybe, or something like that, and just be like, right, we're not paying our taxes, we're independent now. And then they got some, like, spies, assassins, faceless men, an elite force to go down and rescue Arya and Stark.
That's not very northern nobility, is it? They're not going to create an elite force and do a sneaky. They're going to go down with an army of angry Northmen.
I mean, it's obviously at... Yeah, but, like, you know, like...
They could have.
I mean, they did some cloak and dagger stuff, didn't they? Catelyn, okay, not really a Stark, but kind of, you know, in spirit. She snuck down a bit, like, but like,
yeah, I think Robert's Catelyn, not the kind of guy that's like, oh, let's make Delta Force and we'll do a super planned attack. We're going to go in and hit people with a hammer.
And I can see potentially if timelines and circumstance coincided that somehow post Night's Watch John was leading the army north, he would have done it. But I don't see Rob doing that. He's too noble and righteous.
No, I'm not. I mean, in terms of character, you're right. But also,
in terms of logic, absolutely. Task force much better. Set up your army, defend your standpoints, and go from there.
And it seems to me that a lot of people die for basically Sansa and Arya. Now, I'm not saying leave them, forget about them, but like, if you're marching, you know, if thousands of people will die to rescue two noble girls, I got to be honest, I don't know. That doesn't sound like the best trade to me in the most utilitarian of terms.
Yeah, but that's going back to divine blood rights and such, exactly, Starks will be on the throne, got to rescue your blood, got to be loyal to your house, if every character in every fantasy show was 100% logical, it wouldn't be very good.
Yeah. Well, I'm totally. So there we go. But they could have, I
can't imagine Rob being like, nah, Sansa, she can go marry Joffrey. He killed my dad. Oh, well.
Although the thing is, it's like, okay, so if they do decide to become independent, forget the motivations aside. What the fuck can King's Landing do? Like, what are they going to do? March an army all the way up to the north so that they can take the north and what? Like, hunt rabbits or something? Like, the north is not exact. Like, I get it if it was the Reach or something like that, where, like, the Reach, yeah, that's an integral part of the kingdoms. That's important. You lose the Reach, you lose a lot. You lose the north. What the fuck do you lose? Like,
I think maybe it's not so much, again, this is going back to more emotional rather than logical thing, but the North represents a lot of the culture of Westeros in that it's
the first men.
First men. If you don't take the North, then if you're not, the North has such a stubborn, independent streak.
Mm.
If you've got a huge region, no matter how sparsely populated and how strong or weak it is in terms of infrastructure, if that huge amount of space is then saying, no, I don't respect your rule, how long till that attitude spreads? I don't think it's necessarily about the land, it's about the independent spirit. If they're saying we're completely independent, how long does that take before that attitude spreads down and down and down and down, and then King's Landing will be, an island unto itself. I think that's more of the fear than it is for strategical value.
Oh, but they didn't seem. Yeah, I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't buy it.
I mean, that's the words you're saying make sense. And they're backed up by the Greyjoy Rebellion, because the Greyjoy Rebellion happened. Like, who the fuck gives a shit about the Iron Islands? What, say what you want about Euron Greyjoy, but he actually did the best that he could do to make the Iron Islands great again, because at least it had the Iron Fleet.
That's been ruined by modern social political things.
But that's without being good sailors, they got nothing. And so they went out and did the Greyjoy Rebellion. They quelled the Greyjoy Rebellion because why? People give a shit about those islands. No, they don't. It's just, you're right. Like, it's the concept of dominance, really, isn't it? It's the respect of the crown. It's the keeping everyone in line means making an example of that. Yeah. I guess. I mean, is that the commentary that, there's a lot of needless war and stuff?
I don't know.
Yeah. So
I've just noticed that in the scene where they're wrapping up the prostitute to pretend she's asleep, the fabric that they're wrapping her in, the same fabric that's hanging from the ceiling of the tent for their recycling.
Hey, reduce, reuse, recycle.
Just offhand. Yeah. Just little thing.
Anyway, is there much is there much else many thoughts on the actual show that we're supposed to be talking about, Night of the Seven Kingdoms? Because the thing is, it is a 40-minute episode, and also we're introduced to a bunch of characters, but it's to me it was a very soft introduction, and I kind of like it. Like, it's okay, but knowing what's around the corner, it's like.
I reached the end of the episode thinking not much happened. It was a bit slow, but I liked the vibes. I wasn't like at the end of the episode going, oh God, what's going to happen next? Because so much of House of the Dragon was every episode was so high tension.
Yeah.
While this is very light by comparison. So it's kind of, you know, cutting your teeth on a new food type. It's
yes.
very different. It feels very, very different. But I'm enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably go on for another hour about fabrics and costuming and design, but that would probably be very boring.
Well, we will obviously be like the thing is even when it comes to Game of Thrones, it like even right up to the end the costume was not a beat was missed, not a stitch was out of place, and that does carry through because this is the only real show, right? Not Lord of the Rings, not or the Rings of Power, not Wheel of Time, not Merlin,
Witcher, also not even
the Witcher. Like they just don't look real. They look like fantasy. This is the only one where the costumes look. They're not. They don't look like costumes.
I feel like actual fashion houses. So you know, actual fashion companies will have what's called a code. Mm. As part of their like design house system, so that if you were to present an entire runway, they all meet within a certain criteria of the standard you want to set, so it's identifiable as that particular fashion house.
Yeah,
and I think Game of Thrones is the only one that really established its fashion codes very early on, and then were consistent enough with it. I feel like. Particularly, so Witcher and
I will say that just on vibes alone, Witcher did an approach like a comparable level.
I'd say Witcher and Wheel Time have very beautiful, iconic costuming. They very specifically took very modern textiles, very modern fabric. Designs, very modern fashion concepts, and integrated them into the fantasy world. And then because of that, you're not really sure how, like, there isn't, because those fashion concepts are very modern and very, could only really be fashioned out of stuff using what we would understand as modern techniques.
Mm.
Some of the stuff, particularly in Witcher, where they did a lot of, at one point they 3D printed a dress for Yennefer.
3D printed a dress. I don't even know how that looks.
Yeah, there's a bunch of other very modern techniques they used for that sort of thing, and it kind of makes a bit more sense once you've had the spoiled effect of Wheel of Time that it is actually a post-apocalyptic modern historical fantasy, which. Hasn't really been, it was never explained in the series fully until, if you read the books, you kind of understand it a bit better that actually canonically what happens in Rings of Power, not Rings of Power, Wheel of Time, is that our timeline has happened. We went into the future. We had a fantasy future time where there was spaceships and everything. And then society crumbled and died because of outer gods and went back to a medieval era.
Well, yeah, the Wheel of Time.
So their fashion choice, which are slightly postmodernist, makes sense. Yeah. So once you've had that knowledge, you're like, oh, the title makes sense now. Okay, I get it.
It's the wheel.
So a wheel. Oh, yeah, it goes round.
But I think there's a more visceral level to it. Like in Game of Thrones, the world of Game of Thrones, the clothes look worn. A lot of fantasy stuff looks like the clothes were just put on for the first time
modern,
when they started
too
shooting.
Clean.
Too clean. Too clean.
But made once and worn once rather than, you know. One of the things I love about Game of Thrones, particularly between season 4 and 3 to 4 to 5, is Sansa's outfit specifically. She dresses... her dresses with either different linings or different underclothes or different combinations, and then dyes her clothes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So her She wears one dress for about two or three seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on the sequence, she's either wearing a different coloured shawl underneath so it looks different,
mm-hmm.
or she's wearing it with a different belt or a different brooch.
Yeah.
Or later on, she's dyeing it. When she goes incognito, when she runs off with Littlefinger, she's wearing the same dress she's had for like a season. She's just dyed it black.
Oh, okay.
And little things like that I find really good storytelling. So the fabric, like, and again, I've shown you the Bernadette Banner video on the Passion of Thrones. So like you can understand where all of that fabric comes from. And because of that, that tells you about the geography of the world. It tells you about the trading of the world. It tells you about the wealth of the world. It tells you all of this fundamental stuff about the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like Witcher, Ring of the Power, or Wheel of Time have taken that into account with their storytelling. I think Wheel of Time was the one that got closest.
And
there's a point where there's one city in season two or three where like everyone's wearing similar colours. So obviously the dye is good for that particular locality. And there's a point where main character is wearing this ridiculous kind of puffy dress.
Mm-hmm.
It looks kind of silly in high fashion, but then you see a historical portrait and it kind of makes sense that she's wearing like court gown.
Also, let's not forget the moraine hat. The moraine hat, you know, where she wears the hat that's like, it's not hers. She like when it's really hot, Shade of My Heart.
Oh, yeah.
Thing. And
the,
she just
the little straw hat.
The little straw hat that like she's obviously just borrowed off someone, but it's like, I don't know why that would. It's the moraine hat.
I mean, again, like Wheel of Time is the one that I think has come closest to Game of Thrones costume storytelling. And it makes sense when they do more futuristic stuff because it is a post-future story. I feel like Witcher just wanted to do cool costumes. And
you say
really
post-future, but it's the Wheel of Time. Like, it's the time is just wheeled. Like, I feel that you're not taking into account the wheel. But I know what you mean. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is Wheel of Time worth my time to check out? Did it get cancelled?
It got cancelled. Oh, I'd say because it got cancelled, I wouldn't necessarily say yes.
I enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it, and I'd say it improved with every season, and then it got you hyped, and then it's gone. And I started reading the books, and the books are infamous because they are long, in-depth, many, many, many books with many, many, many pages. And they also have the sequel issue of, because books were released, you know, every 1 or 2 years, a lot of the lore that is built, every single book needs to be reestablished and retaught. And so if you're trying to marathon them all, it feels very monotonous after a little while. I think I got to book 7 or 8.
Fair play.
And then I dropped off with the reading, but partially because the series was cancelled, and I was like, I don't want to co-read it as much.
Oh yeah,
the books will always be there. I'd say the series is fine, but it's I don't know if I could recommend watching it because it's incomplete.
I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it on a surface level. Like not a super surface level, but you know, like I'm as a bit of an adventure. Like it's a good adventure. It's an interesting world. The characters are interesting. The characters are pleasant. I think you know, like they're not.
Yeah, they're likable for the most part.
Yeah, even.
And I think the other thing is, as I said, when I was watching, the issue I had with that was Little Witcher and similar to Rings of Power, where there seemed to be the writers fighting something, and I didn't know what they were fighting until I read the books, which is books are very much written to be a F you to Lord of the Rings. They're very much written to be if a wizard turned up in a village and told a bunch of kids that they were destined to become adventurers and, you know, go out into the world and fight monsters, those kids would be the worst and they'd be whining and bickering and they wouldn't want to come along and they'd be complaining about the weather and the roads and they'd be immature and make dumb decisions. And so in the adaptation, they aged up all the characters because in the books, they're like being, which I'm grateful for in some ways, but also they kept some of those personality traits, which makes it very annoying when they're 20 somethings acting like 15-year-olds. And that just it felt like the characters only started to click properly in season 3 for me. The rest of the time, the majority of the main younger cast felt a little bit like they were trying to write two sides of two different people all at once. That being said, I really love Moraine. I love her in the books. I love her in the adaptation. Now, that could be due to the fact that I love the actress a little bit.
Moraine is a good, yeah, like she, you know.
It's a great character.
Great character, yeah, yeah. Actually, now that you said that, that makes a lot of sense, especially when they're like, oh, I don't like working in a pub at the beginning of season one or whatever it is.
It's one of those things you only feel it when you watch it. And then once you read it, you're like, get it. And I don't know how the writers could have resolved that issue, because if they actually cast like 15, 16-year-olds, we would have been so annoyed. But if you take out that fundamental aspect of their characters that is written in the books, the fundamental concept, which is that they are meant to be whiny brats who make dumb decisions, like, you can't take out that aspect without losing a huge amount of what made the books theoretically how special they were.
I wouldn't go so far as to call them brats.
Well, they in the books, they're kind of
okay.
It's a very hard thing to adapt and make it make sense, and it just feels off.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Night of the Seven Kingdoms. Let's talk about Wheel of Time for 15. I would say, because it's incomplete, shit at your own risk. I think that's probably the quickest one. My books are so extensive and deeply intimidating that it's not one of those ones that's easy to finish either story.
Yeah.
Either finishing the books is really intimidating and finishing the series you end incomplete. So watch at your own risk.
I think
I've got some other things that I think I'll probably check out before
I wouldn't call it a priority.
I like it for the adventure. I like it.
The more mature characters are really fun to spend time with. I love spending time with Moraine. I love spending time with like the adults in the room, quote unquote. But the actual primary main characters, a lot of their voices, characters, and presentation in the series is not necessarily enjoyable to spend too much time in.
Meow.
Can you hear Mimi?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can hear Mimi.
I'm so sorry.
No,
on patrol. She did just also throw up on my rug.
I need to
feed that up.
I think she might
have eaten too many treats.
Right, guys, I'm probably gonna have to head off now. I got work tomorrow. Driving buses, because I don't know if I've mentioned on here, but yeah. Got my bus driving license, passed my bus driving test. Well, that's a train. Gotta know, That's the first question you ask you. Is this a bus? Is this a train? If you say it's a train, they don't let you drive a bus.
At least they set the bar nice and high.
Yeah.
You said you drove a double-decker. Do they have triple-deckers?
No. I mean, I've never seen
that. That'd be absurd.
Outside of Harry Potter, no. There's a reason why that was a novelty in the books.
I see.
A double-decker is a standard thing. A triple-decker is a magical thing.
A triple, like, do you know how much a basic bus costs? It's like £300,000. And these new buses.
To be like, I don't know any basic buses.
Some of the newer fancy buses, they can be like £600,000-£700,000. They are pretty fancy.
It's a really nice house.
Frank said if he were to sell his horse, he could eat like a king for like a year or two. So, you know, if you were to steal a bus and then sell it, you could eat like a king for, I don't know, it's cost of living crisis, a week and a half?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Cool. Well, it's good to see you guys again. I'm going to try my best to be as available as possible, but it might be a bit tricky to have any kind of consistency, but I'll do my best. I'll keep you guys in the loop.
Roaches are roaches.
We'll figure it out.
Yep.
And I have a major snowstorm coming tomorrow, so who knows if I'll lose power.
Oh, bless
people
you.
Are ready to see the episode.
Yeah, hopes and prayers.
I'm hoping that. We'll see.
Well, stay safe. Yep.
Thank you.
Is it like snowstorm or?
We're supposed to get a foot of snow.
Yeah. We haven't had a foot, so I've had about an inch of snow, which is perfectly manageable.
Yeah, I think we've had like maybe half an inch. It settled. It was enough to settle and be seen.
Some would say an average amount of snow. An average,
mostly
an average amount of snow. Some would say that is average length. I mean, height. Average height of snow.
The perfect amount of snow. Yeah.
I'd like to see what the average length of snow is.
Yeah,
that would be an interesting mathematical scenario.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll send a picture in the chat to you guys.
I love snow pictures.
I was lucky when we had our snow. I was going out to the bus stop to catch it in for training, and I was literally the first person on my street to destroy the crisp white snow.
Oh, it's satisfying though.
It was. I felt like, oh, I'm the first one out. Yeah. I tell you what though, right? Because I work for a bus company now, I get a free bus pass. I can just travel any of the buses for free whenever I want, and nice. That's really like. I enjoy that a lot. Like, I get the bus most places now because I don't have to pay for parking. I don't have to pay for fuel. I am very close. I probably will be selling my car and we'll just have one car for the house because it's, it's a bit of a pain keeping two cars on the road when you're not really driving them. One car for us.
I will not give up my car unless I absolutely have to because I've got a 40-minute commute as is.
Mm.
And if I were to take the bus, it ups it to an hour and a half.
Yeah. I mean, it's an hour and a half to get, it gets me into Gloucester, but I mean, it's free. I mean, the free helps, you know?
Yeah. Free would help.
Free is good. Anyway. All right. I'm going to close off the podcast now, but thank you everyone for joining us. Comments and shit in the downstairs, and we will see you next time. Oh, also, if you do want to go to projectchronicle.org, that's where the podcast is and stuff. There's not really anything on the podcast that isn't already anywhere else, but I did a podcast. I did a website. I like it. It's good. Looks good. So thank you.
And go we'll visit.
See. Sorry?
I said go visit.
Yeah, go visit. Go visit.
Yeah, pay us a visit.
Yeah. All right. Toodaloo, folks.
Ah.